You didn't know your Jigglypuff from your...
I do know who Jigglypuff is. The point is, I don't want to admit it. That's the point, Neil. I'm playing dumb so that I don't have to talk about Jigglypuff like it's a real thing. And like it's a real thing in my brain.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chad Matlin, Netter at 538. With me in the studio, my forever colleague, Neil Payne. Hello, Neil.
Forever colleague. Nice.
How are you doing today, Neil?
I'm all right. How about you?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah?
You've had a pep in your step this week, Neil. I'd like to see that.
Okay. Maybe I'll bring it to the podcast.
Yeah. Bring that pep to the pod. Pep pod. Kate Fagan, ESPNW's Kate Fagan, is still on book leave. She will be back soon. She's writing that book. Can't wait to read that book. Also can't wait to hear on Hot Takedown. And so, as a result, Neil, we have three guests today. Sort of rotating guest hosts, if you will.
Yeah, that's
experts.
How many people it takes to fill Kate's
right.
spot.
First, we will have 538's Christy Ashwandin, who will join us to talk about the evidence that the Russian government has been helping athletes avoid positive steroid tests and whether the whole Russian delegation should be banned from this summer's Rio Olympics as a result. And then 538's Rob Arthur will call in to talk about something we mentioned on last week's pod, which is that baseball players are hitting more home runs and nobody can seem to figure out why. Rob and his colleague Ben Lindbergh have done some work, and Rob is going to run us through the latest evidence about why the baseball itself may be the reason for that uptick. I find this whole thing super, super fascinating.
Juice balls, Chad.
It speaks to the great conspiracy theorist in my heart, which we can talk about with Rob. And finally, esports are going to make their Hot Takedown debut. Neil, how do you feel about esports?
I feel fine about them, although you were saying that you got made fun of when you were a child for playing video games. Do you want to open up?
It may come as a surprise to Hot Takedown listeners that someone who has found his way to 538 to talk about data and sports on a podcast every week maybe has, you know, a bit of nerdiness in his past. And that that bit of nerdiness was subject to ridicule and skepticism by some of the more mainstream members of his elementary school classes.
The normies, if you will.
I did not call them that, but good to know you did. and as a result, you know, have generally kept closeted any interest in video games I've had since then.
But Chad, I remember you and I actually played
NFL 2K. Why would you out me? I just told you I'm embarrassed to say that I ever played video games, and now you're bringing up the time that we did it together.
You own not one, but two Sega Dreamcasts.
Joe, cut the mic.
Chad.
All right. So anyway, in esports.
Don't run away from your heritage.
Oh my God, a major tournament has ended in esports in a major come-from-behind victory. A man named Hungrybox. A man named Hungrybox has won, and one of ESPN's esports reporters, Jacob Wolf, will be with us to explain what happened and why Hungrybox
is so damned hungry.
Is hungry, is the troll of the esports world, and maybe the greatest Super Smash Brothers Melee player of all time. Okay, now on to the Olympics, which are just a few weeks away. Leading into the Olympics, when the story has not been about Brazil not being prepared for the Olympics, it has been about whether the Russians should even go to the Olympics. Right now, as we're recording on Tuesday afternoon, we are still waiting on word about whether the IOC will ban Russia's delegation from attending the Rio Games because there is evidence that there was state-sponsored manipulation of doping tests, of steroid tests for athletes that came from the government of Russia itself and from the Ministry of Sport. And here to talk about that with us is Christy Ashwandin, 538 science writer. Hello, Christy.
Hi, nice to be back.
Good to have you back. So, Christy, you have written about you've written a lot about sports science and about steroids and doping within sports, both at 538 and before you joined us here. Can you give us a rundown of how we came to this moment where an entire country, a pretty major country, for summer Olympics competition, may be banned from the games?
Sure. So, and I'll just say it's not just Summer Olympics. Their winter delegation also stacked up quite a few medals. And of course, the last Winter Olympics was in Sochi. But where we're at right now, so back in May, the New York Times ran an investigation looking into allegations by a whistleblower named Gregory Rodchenkov. He was Russia's former anti-doping lab director. So he was kind of the guy who was supposed to be in charge of running the anti-doping program there. And what he told the New York Times was about, he sort of described this sordid tale that included things like secret doorways and swapping samples in the middle of the night. But it was sort of dubbed this disappearing positive methodology. And this was sort of a fail-safe system that was ordered and controlled by the state, operated from a Moscow lab. And the purpose here was to protect Russian athletes. So what they would do is swap out positive samples with negative ones so that their athletes wouldn't test positive. And so what just happened yesterday is the World Anti-Doping Agency asked Canadian law professor Richard McLaren to look into these allegations. And so yesterday he presented his 100-page report, which he took care to say it was just a thin slice of what might be out there. McLaren only had about 57 days to produce this, so it was sort of a brief look at the evidence. But basically what happened is he confirmed all of these details that the New York Times had already reported on and showed that this was a very systematic, widespread program for doping and that it took place at the highest levels, that it was really not just a few rogue people, but it was a state-sponsored and administered program.
So, yeah, and some of the samples, I guess they were thought to be tamper-proof, and yet when the investigators looked at it, there was some microscopic evidence that the seals had been broken in order to tamper with the samples. And Rodchenkov, this is my favorite detail from the whole story, he would devise a steroid cocktail that was actually with alcohol, like an actual cocktail.
A true cocktail.
And because it would, I guess, right, hasten absorption of the steroids so that they wouldn't be detected, so they'd go through the body more quickly. And I just could not believe that he chose different alcohols for the different genders of who would be drinking the cocktail. So the men got whiskey, but the women, they couldn't handle the whiskey apparently, which is absurd. And so they got vermouth instead. And that was like such a great small human detail of how this sort of large scale thing works.
And the cocktail had a name. It was Duchess, which is sort of named after this traditional Russian drink apparently. So that was kind of funny as well.
So, okay, so Christy, so we have an outside investigator confirm the evidence of what was once just a whistleblower and a media report. And so now the IOC has a choice to make. And can you lay out how they're going to make that choice and what the choices are? Because it doesn't just have to be a full ban. It could be something else, right?
Right. So what they could do is they could ban individual sports. So some of this began also, there's another whole backstory with the IAAF, which is the governing body of track and field. So they also had a report last fall that outlined a lot of these doping allegations. So the top sport that they were finding these swapped samples was track and field. But anyway, so they could just ban individual sports. That's one option. They could ban individual athletes. So there were specific athletes that had been in this report, in the McLaren report, there were specific athletes that had been shown to sort of be given protection. So it was something like 570-some athletes were on this list of being protected. So they could ban those athletes. One proposal that's been done is there are athletes that are Russian who have been training outside of Russia, so in other countries, and so those athletes might be given a chance. But right now, it looks like the thing that they're looking at is the idea of banning the whole Russian Federation, so all Russian athletes.
And Christy, what happens kind of retroactively now that they have evidence that you know, wrongdoing was done in the past. Russia, going back to the 2012 Olympics, if you include the past two, they've won 115 medals in total. Are these things that might get allocated to, you know, the next best runner-up finisher in the various events, or are there provisions for dealing with that?
Absolutely, there are provisions. And in fact, it was just announced that the IOC is going to retest and sort of reinvestigate Russian athletes and coaches from the 2014 Sochi Games. So those samples will be retested, and they will be doing some police work there as well, probably using this McLaren report to look at that. And so there is a process for this. This has happened numerous times, far too often, where athletes are retroactively awarded medals. And so that's sure to happen here.
And what do they just get them in the mail? They get like a letter one day saying, congrats, you won the bronze.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of is. If they're lucky, you know, maybe their friends and family or their, you know, their sport federation might hold a little ceremony for them.
Play the national anthem.
Yeah, play the national anthem.
A very small platform that they step up on.
Yeah, this actually happened recently to a race walker. I forget his name, but he sort of had a backyard ceremony. You know, I don't know if there was a barbecue or not, but it was funny. He actually found out he had a flat tire or something. I may be getting that detail wrong, but he was on the side of the road somewhere when he got the call from his agent that, oh, by the way, you're now an Olympic medalist. So, yeah, it's not quite the same glory that you would get at the actual games.
So, Christy, can we zoom out just a bit and sort of take stock of this moment in international sports and steroids? Because this, I feel like we've sort of been building to this in a way. I mean, everyone remembers, obviously, the Lance Armstrong allegations that were then denied and later confirmed. And then we have these structures set up, like the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, that seems to have failed in this instance. And I'm wondering sort of where we're at with sort of where steroids are in international sports and where we might be headed.
So I think it's really important to recognize here that the biggest scandals that we've seen here and the biggest sort of things that have happened where we've found a lot of dopers have not come from testing. Like the testing, it's pretty clear at this point that testing is very ineffective. I mean, this has always been the case. The dopers are always one or two steps ahead of the tests. And so a lot of what the tests can do, though, is serve as a deterrent. So they change the way that they may not be able to entirely stop doping, but they may change the way that it's done. But what we're seeing here is that it's really the investigations and the police work that are uncovering this stuff. And so that means that the testing system, you know, is broken, at least in some way. Another really important thing that happened here is we know now that WADA had been informed of some of this stuff from Russia. They'd had whistleblowers who had contacted them, and they didn't do anything. So they are not investigating these things in any sort of timely manner. And the pattern that seems to be arising is, you know, athletes go to the federation or go to WADA or they go to their national anti-doping agency. This is something that happened in the U.S. There were some runners that came to USADA with allegations, and eventually they became so frustrated with the lack of, you know, any progress on these cases that they end up going to the media. And it's only when the stuff explodes in the media that something's really dumb. It's clear that whatever they're doing is pretty ineffective in terms of looking into investigating whistleblowing. It's not clear that whistleblowers, you know, they really have the backs of the whistleblowers when they come to them. And, you know, so a lot of people are saying, look, the system's broken. And, you know, I think that they have an argument to make there.
And is this a situation where, so like you, it sounds like from what you just said that we're kind of just waiting on whistleblowers to emerge more than anything else to kind of catch whoever else is out there. Do we have reason to think that that this is more than just an isolated incident with Russia, but that, you know, the evolution of doping has kind of, you know, continued its progress over the years, and that, you know, other countries might also be engaging in similar activities?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, we've seen, I think that this is the only instance we have of a nation doing this, but we've seen other programs in sports. I mean, the Lance Armstrong case is one example of that. We had the Balco scandal a few years ago. Again, that was a whistleblower that uncovered that case. So the problem here is we don't we really have no good way of knowing how widespread doping is. And so you sort of have this culture where people feel like, well, everyone must be doing it, and that, you know, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But we don't have good data. Like, the only stats that we have here are about who gets caught. And of course, only the dummies get caught, because you sort of have to screw up to get caught the way the system is now.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like, one of the ways maybe to deter people from doing it is to have the data that shows that not as many people are doing it as maybe it appears, mm-hmm. without there being complete data.
But then the flip side, I was going to say, the flip side is that, the best people at it are the ones that are so far ahead of the testers that they're not getting caught.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I think that some of the most interesting work being done on this stuff is probably by the dopers and their doctors and whatnot. You know, they're experimenting and playing around and doing things. So now we have things like microdosing. So it used to be people would take large doses of steroids or of blood boosters, but now they'll just sort of do it to the limit. So basically what the tests have done have sort of been to put a speed limit on it. So you can dope, but only up to this point, at which point you'll be caught.
Okay. Listeners, you can read more of Christie's coverage of the Russian doping scandal at 538. We'll put a link on our show page. Christie, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And now a word from Hot Takedown's sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using your phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Get a custom mortgage solution at your own pace, whenever and wherever you want. So if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/takedown. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. Again, if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/takedown. Okay, on to baseball now, where the home runs continue to fly and nobody can figure out exactly why. Inadvertent
rhyme.
Wow,
look at that rhyme, Chad.
Inadvertent. All right, so we talked about this a bit last week, but the question on hand is, why is it that 2 years ago, there were 0.86 home runs per team per game, and yet this season so far, there's 1.16 homers per team per game. That 1.16 is up from last year as well, where it's 1.01. So we're on a three-year, if this year holds through the end of the year, we're on a three-year trend. And last year, right around August, the real spike started to happen. So here to talk about that is Rob Arthur, 538. Rob Arthur, hello, Rob.
Hey, Jed.
Thanks for coming on. Okay, so Rob, you and Ben Lindbergh have wrote a piece before the season started, trying to figure out last year's uptick in home runs. You want to just run us through what you found in that one, and then we'll talk about this year?
We noticed around midseason last year, actually around the time of the All-Star break, after that, home runs started spiking very rapidly. And it was this very, very much a tale of two seasons, in the sense that the first half of the season, home run rate was on the trajectory that it had been for the last two seasons. It was quite low, like you were saying, around 0.86. Then the All-Star break happened and it just went way, way up, almost to the level that we're seeing now. So we were confused about that. We wanted to dig into that and find out what happened. So we looked at the StatCast exit velocity numbers that are now available. So measuring the speed of the ball leaving the bat. And what we found is that exit velocity had increased really dramatically around the time of the All-Star break. And in fact, the increase in exit velocity of about 1 mile per hour on average was completely enough to explain, that the increase in home run rate.
Because the idea being that the harder you hit it, the further it goes, and then obviously if the angle's right, it goes over the wall.
Exactly, exactly. So we tried to investigate a few different reasons why exit velocity might be increasing and why that might be driving this home run rate increase. So we looked at the players, and it seemed like generally there was this across-the-board increase. It wasn't that there were a bunch of new players coming into the league around midseason that were hitting it much harder. It seemed like basically everyone saw their exit velocity increase. And even if you focused on guys that were in the league playing from the start of the season to the end of the season, basically full-time players, those guys also saw their exit velocity increase. We looked at weather. We looked at all sorts of things, and basically nothing could explain it. So eventually we got around to thinking that maybe it's something to do with the ball. That's one of the things that can change, and, you know, nobody would really know. So to look at that, we bought two lots of balls, one that were Bud Selig signed, so we knew that they were from 2014 or earlier. They were manufactured when Selig was still the commissioner, and one that was Rob Manfred signed. And we sent these balls to a sports science laboratory at Washington State University and got them fired from a cannon at a steel plate to measure how bouncy they were. And that bounciness, the technical term for it is the coefficient of restitution. That is really extremely important for determining how quickly they come off the bat. It determines for every amount, for every bit of energy that goes into the bat from the hitter, how much of it comes out in terms of the exit velocity on the ball that, and how far the ball will end up going. And we saw that there was this small but not quite significant increase in the bounciness. So it was about half as much as we would need to explain the increase in exit velocity. And unfortunately, the tolerances on Major League Baseballs are surprisingly loose in the sense that a given ball can be extremely different in terms of this bounciness from another ball. In fact, the same ball, if you hit it with the exact same amount of energy, can fly, two different balls that are both certified by MLB for use in a game. One, if it's hit with the exact same amount of energy as the other one, can hit, can go 49 feet further.
Yeah, it's really a difference between a home run and a fly.
Harmless fly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
So just to get us up to speed then, so you found that there was lots of variability within the ball, but we couldn't confirm it was the ball that was happening.
Right.
Then we see a further uptick this year, and you, Neil, and Ben have been working on this piece that tries to and it'll be up later on 538 later this week. It suggests that it almost has to be the ball, especially because of the work that you did comparing it to the minor leagues.
Right. So we saw that the home runs are up again this year, and similarly, exit velocity is up again this year. And we thought about just buying some more balls, but again, we're concerned that there's just so much variation between balls that we wouldn't be able to detect the difference, even if we sent, you know, dozens of balls to the laboratories.
And that's expensive, right?
Extremely expensive. Yeah, thousands of dollars. And the other problem is that, you know, we don't have a good way to get the actual balls that would be in use in a Major League Baseball clubhouse, right? So we can buy them offline on the website, but we don't know if those could be different from the ones that actually end up getting shipped to the Cubs clubhouse, for example.
Have you thought about crowdsourcing and having people send you their foul balls and home run balls that they received?
We did actually think about that, or buying some game used balls like off eBay or something. But the problem is that the collision, when it happens, it changes the bounciness of the ball. And so, unfortunately, we'd have to kind of account for that, and it would be tough to do that rigorously. We'd have to, I think, get a whole bunch of balls if we were going to do that, like maybe 100 or so, and that would be prohibitively expensive in and of itself. So we were wanting to come up with a different way of approaching the same question, and Ben pointed out that there's this sort of natural control in the sense that the minor leagues, in particular the high minor leagues, are filled with many of the same players that eventually go on to play in Major League Baseball. And they're using the same bats, the same equipment, except not the same ball. And we can look at how their home run rates have tracked with Major League Baseball and how they might have changed in the last year and a half that we've seen this huge spike in home run rates in MLB.
So is there, there tends to be a relationship between the home run rate in the majors and in the minors?
Yeah, quite a good correlation. We found that there was this correlation of about 0.57 between the home run rate in AAA and the home run rate in MLB. And that kind of makes sense because, like I said, it's mostly the same hitters. Now, there are fewer home runs in the minor leagues because the players tend to be not as strong, not as powerful. That's why they're in the minors and not in the majors. But generally, when home runs go up in the minors, they also go up in the majors. And this kind of helps to counteract one of the main arguments that we saw against our piece before, which is that something about the players was different, right? That somehow the players were selling out for power, or the hitters had just gotten ahead of pitchers in some way, or pitchers were only focusing on velocity and not on command. if that was the case, then you would expect the home run rate to spike in the minors in AAA when it also increases in MLB. And for the most part, it does, except for this past 2 years when the gap in home runs on contact has been just huge, about 50% larger than it had been on average over the past 25 years. So really, they'd been tracking really well for 25 years, the home run rates in the AAA and the majors, until the last couple of years, at which point they've diverged dramatically.
Okay. I find this, like, endlessly fascinating because it gets – because Manfred has said it's not the balls or anything, right? Didn't he just give a press conference at All-Star Break that said, like, nothing?
He said it was, what, hitters batting – power hitters batting higher in the lineup or something?
Right. His general idea for it was that it's something to do with the strategy that somehow major league teams are selling out for power. They're optimizing their lineups in such a way as to put power hitters higher in the lineup. Something like that, which really doesn't hold water at all. In fact, the best power hitters, they always tend to be fairly high up in the lineup, and if anything, they're getting like slightly fewer plate appearances than they used to, perhaps because there's, you know, more of an emphasis on OBP now, which is really more important for lineup order.
Now, and in fact, you guys ended up looking at the same exact kind of groups of batters and pitchers that appeared in both AAA and the major leagues, right? So even the idea that, like, the using hitters in a different way, they're the same hitters.
Right. So to be absolutely certain that there's no funny business going on with different strategies or different hitters, we focused in on just the hitters who had taken plate appearances in both AAA and MLB. And then we looked at how well they did when they were in AAA versus when they were in MLB. And we found that generally they hit 30%, the same hitters and the same pitchers, they hit 30% more home runs when they were playing in Major League Baseball than when they were playing in AAA.
That's so crazy!
And, yeah. So there's not, I mean, we also filtered out the effect of the ballpark, so it's not that. We even looked at, you know, exactly the exact same pitcher hitter combination. So, you know, literally the same matchup. And when that's happening, you still get this really elevated rate of home runs when the same guys are facing each other in MLB versus in AAA. And so the only thing that we could think of after looking at all this was that the only difference is the ball. Maybe there are other differences that we're unaware of between the leagues, but as far as we can tell, that seems to be the one that jumps out.
And the balls are manufactured and stored and all of this, that, and the other thing in different locations and by different companies for the majors and the minors?
It's the same company. It's Rawlings for both the minor league and the major league ball, but it's in the factories are in two different locations. So the major league balls are manufactured in Costa Rica. The minor league balls are manufactured in China, and according to testing that MLB's own research lab has done, the minor league balls are slightly different from the major league balls. So it was conceivable to us that perhaps there was a change in the major league ball that didn't affect the minor league ball, and that's why we have these diverging home run rates in the two different leagues.
And that also makes sense given the fact that the minor league rate of home runs per contact has kind of followed the same trajectory that both it was following in the past and also that the majors were following in the past, right? It's just the majors that have kind of diverted off of this parallel path that they usually follow between the two levels.
Right. They both minor and major league home run rates were sort of on this steady, slow decline and had been since the height of the steroid era. They were sort of returning to the pre-steroid era levels. That was not the case for the majors in the past year and a half. All of a sudden it spiked. But what happened in AAA was that it was just continuing that slow and steady decline, very close to the trend line.
And Rob, can you just tell us for the final time why steroids are not the answer here?
Yeah, so, I mean, we can't rule it out, right? We definitely have no conclusive evidence against it, but Ben said it really well in the piece. This happened really suddenly around the time of the All-Star break. So to believe that it's steroids, you have to believe that all of a sudden, at the same time, in July of 2015, all of the hitters in the league started taking this undetectable performance-enhancing drug that helped them to just an incredible degree, inflated their power, you know, tremendously, and didn't help pitchers at all. And it was all done, you know, simultaneously in concert across the league. That's really tough to believe.
So very interesting. So Rob, you think it's the balls, right? I understand that you don't want to, the evidence is not as conclusive as you would like, but in your heart of hearts, put aside your quantitative empirical mind, based on everything that you know, where is your gut pointing you on this?
Well, I want to be careful to say that I don't think it's likely to be any single thing. Mm. I think that with the increase being as pronounced and dramatic as it is, I think it would be really surprising if the ball completely explained all of it. I think there might be something to different tactics in the majors versus the minors, or major league teams getting better about coaching or something like that. But with all that said, I think those factors are probably the peripheral things that added, you know, 0.1 miles per hour to exit velocity. I think based on what we've seen in the majors and the minors and our testing results before and just how rapidly the increase in exit velocity occurred, yeah, I think the ball is the most likely culprit for the majority of the increase in home runs that we're seeing in Major League Baseball.
All right, listeners, send us your best conspiracy theories to podcasts@538.com. Read Rob and Ben's piece, which is an incredible piece of detective work. That like has that great sort of detective story thing where you sort of think you know the answer at the end, but there's always the chance for a sequel that turns everything upside down and tells you that what you thought you knew was wrong all along. Rob Arthur, thanks for coming on Hot Takedown talking about it.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, last week, the Evo competition ended. I think it ended over the weekend. Evo is an esports fighting game tournament, in which athletes compete and some win. And Hungrybox was the victor in Super Smash Bros. Melee, which is why we are here to talk about Hungrybox's win with the one and only Jacob Wolf from ESPN. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm doing very well.
Thanks for joining us. All right, so Hot Takedown is new to the esports game.
Very new.
Can you just give us a rundown of sort of the scene? Because we're only going to talk about, my understanding is, a small slice and sliver of it, because we're only talking about this one game within this one genre, within this one tournament, et cetera, within the larger scene.
Right, so esports, imagine every sport that you watch, whether it be football, basketball, baseball, no matter what it is. Imagine all of those coming together and having one name, just like sports, right? So that's basically esports, and each individual esport is its own game or its like own sport. So basically, the fighting game community and overall Evo had 9 different sports taking place in one arena. Being the Las Vegas Convention Center on Friday and Saturday, and then the Mandalay Bay was 5 of those 9 competing in their top 8, which are basically their finals.
And thousands of people come in person to watch this happen. And let's play a little tape of Hungrybox's victory in Super Smash Bros. Melee.
They are up there. That'll do it. Obama's got one last chance
of
life.
Your energy must go to the skies. Whose ear is this?
Ooh! Eats a back air. This is big. He recovers. Tournament winner.
Yeah, Hungrybox presses forward on the gray stick, and that's the end of Evo 2016. Hungrybox has put a miraculous win in set one of grand finals, and able to beat Armada on such strong counterpick to stage the box. And the book of who is the best of all time in Melee is open. As wide as possible.
Yes.
So wide, wow. The spine is broken. Okay, so Jacob, can you tell us why Hungrybox is maybe the greatest of all time after this victory over the weekend?
You know, I don't know if I would say he's the greatest of all time, but he is what is considered one of the 5 gods of Super Smash Bros. Melee. And essentially what those players are being Armada, who he obviously beat, Mewtwo King, Mango, PPMD, and himself. Historically in the history of this game, they have been the best players that always are at the top. You nearly always see them in top 8 at tournaments, and all of them were in top 8 last year at Evo,
So esports are a very top-heavy league.
The thing is with Melee, there's over 100 competitors that are stacked up in this thing called the SSBM rank, And essentially, there are players in this. There are players in the top 10 that do take games off these gods. And there's one in particular named Leffen who couldn't make it because of visa delays, who has taken a game off of all of them, and they call him the God Slayer. yeah. But even this weekend, Plup, who is the seventh best player on that list, took a game off Hungrybox. He took two games to win a series, but Hungrybox bounced back, and that was the big part of it. And when we interviewed him over the weekend, he told us that basically the entire time he was doubting himself, and that his coach, Lewis, who is the first coach to ever be in Super Smash Bros. Melee, basically just kept encouraging him. And every time he said he couldn't do it, Lewis told him he could. And he went back up there, and he made the loser's bracket run, and he won the tournament.
Now, you mentioned the player rankings. Are those based just on, you know, who wins and who loses and how tough of a competition that you faced? Or are there even, like, kind of finer-grained analytics that go into the actual mechanics of winning and losing these matches?
It's primarily results that they're ranked on. So they look at, last year at least, they looked at every big tournament, every super major tournament. So Apex, which was in February of last year, and then CEO, which is the summer tournament that I went to last month, but they used last year's, obviously, because it's compiled at the end of the year. So CEO, Evo, the Big House 5, and I feel like I'm missing, oh, and DreamHack, which is one of the newer ones.
Jacob, can I interrupt real quick? So you're sure. saying that the rankings are based off of win losses and not off of any underlying quality of the players. We talk a lot on the show about whether or not wins and championships are the way to judge the quality of a player or a team, or should it be the sort of the fundamentals, right? If a player is hitting 340 in baseball, but like Mike Trout, but his team's not good and he's not winning any championships, should Mike Trout be judged unfairly based on that, despite not getting as many wins as players on other teams? But you're saying that in esports, wins still do carry the day?
Yeah, primarily. It depends on the esport, obviously. When it comes to Super Smash Bros. Melee, it's really hard to see what is analytics in terms of in-game stuff. When it comes to other esports like League of Legends and Counter-Strike, it's much easier and there's much better analytics for that because there's things like kills and deaths, and you can look at both. There's, you know, when how many bullets do you shoot in Counter-Strike Global Offensive and how many of those do you hit, similar to a batting average, obviously. And then in League of Legends, there's kills, there's deaths, there's assists, there's different analytics depending on what role you play. So it's a little bit easier in the team games to determine your individual role. However, in Super Smash Brothers, it's different because there's not like a set way to win the game. You win the game off certain techniques which you come up with yourself, and that's how that's how you win. And it's a fighting game, so it's very reactionary. So there's not any like base analytics that you could look at where you could in the other team games.
Now, I'm going to step out on a limb here and guess that there might also be, I'm kind of assuming, but I'll ask you, is there gambling on these results? Are there people who are kind of, you know, placing bets on who will win and who will lose and kind of tracking that in real time?
Not on Super Smash Bros.
Okay. But on other games?
On some of the other games, yes. Obviously, it's very well regulated on certain games, and there's actually been, in the past few weeks, there's been a big scandal about gambling and betting on Counter-Strike Global Offensive that was unregulated because you would use skins instead of actual money, skins being in-game items that you can buy or earn, or like get through randomized drop boxes, basically. And overall, like that was such a big deal, and now Valve, the developer, stepped in last week and said, you know, we're not going to allow this anymore because this is unregulated and underage gambling, and are now basically sending cease and desist to every site that does it and taking them down.
So, Jacob, let me ask you this. In sports, there are different skill sets that apply to different sports differently, right? If I'm a really fast
right.
runner, I might be better in track and field than I am in football or something like that. I love football.
Yeah, right.
It has its own speed. So are there different, and you said each game is its own sport in esports. So
right.
are there different skill sets from the athletes that make you better at one even fighting sport than another, for example? So, like, is there a reason why Hungrybox competes in Super Smash Bros. Melee using the character Jigglypuff, is my understanding, as opposed to doing some other game, Street Fighter or something like that?
Yeah, you know, it's usually based on what you're best at, and you know, a lot of these esports athletes come from being video gamers as just a core, right? It's something most of us, myself included, did growing up, and it depended on which one we felt we were best at. And overall, you know, Hungrybox has been playing this game for almost 14 years, and just he's been very good at it. And it does depend. Obviously, the big one is, or used to be the biggest game in the world, which was StarCraft. In StarCraft, what matters most is how fast you can click and how fast you can use your keyboard.
You're saying that uses a different skill set, both brain and physically, than a fighting game would, for example.
Correct, because in StarCraft, your whole objective is how many actions per minute can you do on your keyboard or your mouse to build the biggest army, to build the biggest resources, and then go beat your opponent.
Okay, but if Hungrybox faced a schlub like me in a game other than his premier sport, Super Smash Brothers, he'd still kick my butt, right?
Probably.
Okay.
His hands are incredibly fast because of how fast he has to be and how reactionary he has to be on that GameCube controller of his. So,
are there any of these top-ranked players who cross over in multiple different games or even like multiple different genres, or do they tend to kind of stick with that bread and butter that they've, you know, played, like you said, for like 14 years?
It does depend. There are players like Anti, who just won CEO last month, and he's a top Super Smash Brothers for Wii U player, which is a different version of Smash. And he's also pretty decent at Street Fighter and can do well, just because he puts time into both of them and really practices. There's a player called Mewtwo King, who's one of the five gods, who does both versions of Smash and is very good at both of them. Better at Melee than he is at 4, just because he puts more time into Melee, and it's what he's done for 15 years of his life. But usually other esports athletes, they usually stay within a genre or within the game.
Jacob, I have two more questions for you. The first is, where does Hungrybox go from here? He's won his first championship. He's gotten the monkey off his back. He's on the scoreboard. His legacy is maybe, you know, beginning to be built in the way that he wants it to be built. What is next for Hungrybox?
I'd actually say, and this is something he said to me over the weekend after the win, I would say this is the end of his, an end of an era for Hungrybox. He has been a top player for so long. He's won so many events over the past 10 years of his life, and finally he's won the big one. Because Evo is not, like, just because it's the biggest doesn't mean it's the only. And, you know, a month ago in Orlando, Hungrybox won in his hometown and beat top players there. So he's won so many tournaments. He's considered one of the five gods. He'll always remain as one of the best players to ever play this game. And this is an end of an era for him, I believe. I think this is finally what cements him as one of the best of all time.
He goes from a god to a goat.
Yes. Yeah, wow. Yeah. You know what? It's pretty funny. That's probably the best way to describe it.
Jacob, one last thing, as my producer frantically tells me to wrap it up. For those of us who, such as myself, who have been resistant to the esports wave despite ESPN airing it on TV, despite hearing that thousands of people are watching in person, despite, you know, hundreds of thousands of people watching it when it's on TV, it being a big part of internet culture, depending on the corner of the internet you're in. Is this a foregone conclusion that esports are going to be with us for the next, you know, several decades, that to resist it is futile?
Yeah, I believe so. I think that esports is going to stick around. It may not be these games forever, but it will continue to be more games. Game developers are publishing competitive games, or games that could be competitive, all the time. And I believe that esports will continue and continue and continue, and I really just think this is the time.
All right. Whew. This is just all very interesting to me. It makes me feel old, Neil. It does. I don't know how to explain it. Jacob Wolf, one of ESPN's esports writers. Jacob, thanks very much for coming on and giving us a look inside esports.
Thanks.
All right, now the time in our show when Neil Payne brings us a telling number from the world in sports, our significant digit. Neil, I'm just anointing you our official.
I know, increasingly that has been the case.
Bringer. Neil, my understanding is this Sig Dig involves two of your favorite things, baseball and the Simpsons.
Yeah, sure, sort of at least. So the Sig Dig this week is 100, and that's the number of games that a hypothetical team would win in a 162-game baseball season if it contained the players that Roger Clemens, 53-year-old Roger Clemens, and his buddies have assembled to play in something called the National Baseball Congress this summer. So just a little background on this. The National Baseball Congress is it's in Wichita, Kansas. It's this amateur semi-pro baseball tournament-type thing that used to be a big deal before the minor leagues existed, and now it's just for amateur players. But Roger Clemens, news broke this week that he and some other retired major league players decided to get together and form in this league that usually is reserved for college players and amateurs. They were going to form a team based where 24 of the 25 players on the roster
are former steroid users.
Well, at least former Major League Baseball players, the only exception being Roger Clemens' son, Kobe, who never played in the majors. Of course, you have to get the nepotism in there. But the other players on the team include, I mean, this pitching staff, if you took the peak seasons, which is where I got that 100-win number from, that sig dig, if you took the peak seasons for these players, this is a team that would have Roger Clemens, Josh Beckett, Brad Penny, Roy Oswalt, Jason Isringhausen, former Met, and achieved success elsewhere. The hitters would include J.D. Drew, Rick Ankiel, Adam Everett, the great shortstop who was always kind of held up compared to Derek Jeter as being the exemplar of great defense as opposed to garbage defense. I didn't mention Tim Hudson also on the pitching staff. A few other sort of all-star, borderline all-star players. Brandon Inge, I think, was in there at one point. Adam LaRoche. I don't know if his son Drake is allowed in the locker room in this. Brad Penny also on the pitching staff. Nate Robertson, who pitched for the Tigers for a while. Ben Sheets, who was very good for a while. Anyway, this group of ringers has come together and assembled a team, and they're going to play against a bunch of college kids. And probably, frankly,
they're just old ringers. That's the only salvation,
they're old.
Right?
That's the only salvation there in there. But a lot of these players are still in their 30s and haven't, you know, been too far removed from the game. So I don't know whether to chide them for bringing in all of these ringers on a team, or to just be like, wow, this is going to be ridiculous to see a team of major leaguers mow through amateur competition. But it also recalled, if I was going to do this exercise for this team that actually exists, the greatest team of ringers ever assembled, I think, in baseball history, has to be the softball team that was assembled by Mr. Burns for the Springfield Power Plant in The Simpsons, and that was a team that had Roger Clemens, again, the same guy as its pitcher. It also had Wade Boggs, Ken Griffey Jr., Steve Sachs, Ozzie Smith, Jose Canseco, Don Mattingly, Daryl Strawberry, and Mike Socia. Mm. So that team, if they were able to find average players to surround themselves with, specifically an average pitching staff to pitch on the days in which Clemens wasn't pitching, that team would win about 114 games if they were all kind of put together in the best years of their career. So that team is better than the team that Clemens has put together. But at the same time, I think it's just kind of ridiculous that this team, that if they were all together at their best moment of their career, would win 100 games, is now going to just presumably wipe the floor with a bunch of college kids.
So a couple things. One small correction. Adam LaRoche and Nate Robertson put the team together, not Clemens.
Oh, okay.
What I'm seeing. Never, that aside.
So they picked Kobe Clemens just in
and
of...
I'm sure Roger, you know, said, listen, I'll play if I can spend some time with my son.
Right.
I think, Neil, I think you got to go to this thing, right?
I mean, it might be an argument
July
to send 29th me out there.
July 29th through August 13th. Buy tickets now. It's the 82nd NBC World Series. Wow.
Yeah. It's been around for a long time.
All right, Neil, we'll talk later about how you can get to Kansas.
Get to Wichita.
All right, that will do it for this week's show. Neil, thanks for chatting with me about sports.
Thank you, Chad.
Even
esports.
Always a pleasure for you to embarrass me and tell people that I used to play video games in my life. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast Godslayer is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Jorge Estrada and Tony Chow. Cetridge Crawford is 538's sports intern this summer. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Don't forget to send those conspiracy theories. You can find us on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Review and rate us while you're there. Thank you for the new reviews and ratings. It was a big help. And don't forget to find What's the Point and 538 Elections while you're there. We're on other podcasting apps as well, of course. I use Downcast. Neil, what's your podcast app of choice?
Sometimes I SoundCloud it up.
Ooh, retro. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.
Well, Mr. Burns had done it. The power plant had won it. With Roger Clemens clucking all the while. Mike Socia's tragic illness made us smile. While Wade Boggs lay unconscious on the barroom tile. We're talking softball. From Maine to San Diego, talking softball. Mattingly and Canseco. Ken Griffey's grotesquely swollen jaw. Steve Sachs and his running with the law. We're talking Homer. Ozzie and the Straw. We're talking softball. From Maine to San Diego, talking softball. Mattingly and Canseco, Ken Griffey's grotesquely swollen jaw. Steve Sachs and his running with the law. We're talking Homer, Ozzie and the Straw.